Thanks very much, Belinda. Good morning. And yeah, thanks for taking time out on a day when you've got a deadline. That's much appreciated. Look, the world is awash with data. In fact, every year the IT industry picks a few buzzwords and hammers them into the customers and says, this is how you've got to think about the future. And the one that really kicked off last year and is skyrocketing this year is big data. And we're going to be hearing so much about that if you haven't already. Now, what does big data mean? Nothing. It's a marketing term. We've always had data. It's just the speak that we've had. You know, computers are about data. But the important thing to remember is that, you know, it's no longer on paper. It's no longer our communications in telegraph or on the telephone or whatever it might be. We are generating vast amounts of data constantly. It is being sucked into commercial and government databases and spat back out at us in ways that we have only just begun to imagine. So whenever someone starts saying big data, the first thing is to kind of remember, A, it's your data, and that they're trying to sell you something. Indeed, I'm trying to sell you something too today. I'm trying to sell you on the idea that this internet revolution, whatever you want to call it, we're a couple of decades into some kind of massive change in society anyway. But I have the theory that it is going to change society at every level. And that's not a particularly controversial theory, but just remember that information is power. We're replumbing the way information flows around the entire planet, and that means the whole power structure changes. So I know that the word power is in the name of this particular subject, so think about that. And just remember that as people who are going to be making media, or at least have a very strong interest in it in the future, you are part of that process of deciding where we go in the future. So my political message, and I'll then squash it, is really I'm encouraging you to take an active role in that process of developing the future, because it's for you and not so much for old farts like me. Housekeeping, as Belinda said, informal. Stop and ask questions if you like. I don't mind. I might throw in a few questions for you. I am recording it because I will put this on my website later along with the slides, links to everything I mention, maybe a transcript. And I do that afterwards because if you ask a question and I think, yes, you need to know about this, I'll add that to the links. So that'll be up in a few days' time. If, when you ask a question, you do not wish your voice to appear on the recording, the safe word is penguin. So, our topic, three parts. I'm going to run through what all this data is, where it's coming from, who's collecting it, and where it's going. And then I'm going to talk about what you can then do with all this data that's being gathered. And the third part is really where I think this might go in the future. And I'll illustrate it along the way with actual real-world things that are happening right now that you may or may not have heard about. Now, Belinda's already given my background, so I don't need to explain why I might be interested in any of this. But let's start off with the most important thing to realise from the first moment. Everything you do on the internet is public and is tracked by at least someone. Probably many people. Here's the West Australian website from this morning, actually. So there's a bit about Senator Scott Ludlam, I see there, lower left, obviously some footy tipping. And I've highlighted with a subtle arrow the fact that this is actually a website that's part of the Yahoo group. And that because I had yesterday logged into my Flickr account, which is also owned by Yahoo, they already know who I am. I have never, ever logged in to the West Australian's website, ever. Nevertheless, they are tracking every story I happen to read. If you dig into the code for the website, you'll find that every time you look at a page on the West Australian, and this is typical of any news website around the planet, these are the other five companies who are also tracking that fact. Yahoo, of course, Yahoo 7, the parent company here in Australia, or Yahoo's the parent in the US and it's the other way around. DoubleClick, which is owned by Google. That's their advertising sales network for banner ads, not to be confused with Google's text ads. But DoubleClick is one of the biggest advertising brokers in the world. Nielsen, the ratings company. You'll probably know them from radio and television. They do net ratings as well. So they're keeping track of what you read the West Australian. Right Media, which is another one that's a metrics and measuring company. Right Media, I think, specialises in mobile advertising, but I'm not 100% sure. And iBlaster, yet again, another advertising management and metrics service. So already, just by hitting this one website, and you've got five companies tracking everything you do. Now, remember that most mainstream media outlets around the world will be subscribing to Nielsen Net Ratings, for example. So that means every website that you visit that has Nielsen's code in it, that means Nielsen is building a profile of everything you happen to look at, whether that's the football results at the West Australian or political news at the Australian or even the ABC, because they use the same code. They want to know who's tracking it. So the media companies get back a bit of information about their audience. Nielsen get this wonderful dossier of everything you've looked at. Nielsen will also occasionally pop up a questionnaire saying, oh, look, we're just doing some research. This is solely for research. But you mind filling in your age, your place of birth, the languages you speak at home, your income level, whether you're married or not, etc. It's just for research. Research is a lovely word. Now, this happens on mobiles as well. And that's where it gets interesting. This is on my Android phone. Clueful. It's an app from Bitdefender, which is information security based in Bucharest in Romania. And I must admit, I quite like talking to the European information security companies. They tend to have a kind of midway approach between, yeah, we're Americans, and via Russian, we will take care of you. The Europeans are kind of used to being in the middle. Bitdefender has this app called Clueful. You run it on your, on this case, Android phone, and I'm pretty sure they have it for iPhone as well. And that tells me that on my phone, I have 49 apps that are a moderate privacy risk and 9 that are low. None that are high risk. That's a good thing. I step through at the moderate privacy risk, and it tells me, for example, that Scanner Radio, an app that allows me to listen to police scanners and emergency services radio communications. I had that on my phone when all the bushfires were up in the Blue Mountains. That's where I spend a lot of my time. So I wanted to listen to them allocating where the fire trucks were going to be going. That leaks my private data, and three more kinds of information. Sensitive data, reads SMS. If I click through to one of those, the Scanner Radio one, it can send my location over the internet. I'm kind of, yeah, I want to know which police frequencies are nearest me. It can leak my unique device ID, the unique serial number of my phone. I'm kind of going, why do they need that? They don't. It can connect to Facebook. Yeah, so I can say on Facebook that I'm listening to this, but that means at that moment Facebook goes, ping, you're listening to a radio, you are in this location, and here is your phone ID. It needs to connect to the internet to stream the radio down for me to listen. So that's fair enough, but it means once it's connected to the internet, it can talk to anyone it likes. Here's another app. TrustGo is another information security company. Their little ad detector will scan the code of all of the apps on my phone and tell me what they can do. And it tells me that there are 21 apps that leak my identity information, that is the serial number of my phone or my phone number or my email address or something, and 20 of them collect my location. And I don't have a lot of apps on my phone. Let's look at one of them. Well, actually, let's just drill down to the collect location. I find it deeply ironic that AVG's privacy fix software is considered a privacy risk. I'll colour that up with them next week. I only did these screenshots this morning. I went, oh, really? Flight radar, which shows me where all of the commercial airliners are near me. Yeah, that needs to know my location. Google search. Yeah, it'll tell me where the closest restaurants are. But here's the other interesting thing about it. All of those apps have embedded in them code from AdMob, which is a mobile advertising brokerage. So that means AdMob are building up a complete profile of where I am, which apps I'm using when, and therefore, if I'm using the embedded apps, it means they can tell which Google searches I've just performed. They can tell who I've been talking to in the Google Hangouts. They can tell which movie I've just watched because their code is embedded in the page. I go to movies, I say, play this movie, and the ad code says, oh, I am in the page that's playing Game of Thrones Series 4, Episode 2. And there's that. So all that is compiled. How many of you are thinking this is new information for you? I'm just curious to see how many people are aware of this kind of stuff. Not a single hand, you're lying. Okay, I know that actually, I test that because over the last year, I think we've all become a lot more aware of that. You have a question?
Sorry, I was aware of it, Will, but I was just thinking, like, why would they need so much information?
That's a very good question, and I'll get to that once we talk about what we can do with the information. Oh. Though I think it's fair to say at the moment that any of these companies are collecting as much as they can get away with. And we are way ahead of understanding fully what we can do with the information. But I've got a few examples coming up which will help with that. Now, this is a picture of the screen you get if you use the Firefox web browser and put in a plugin called Collusion. As you are browsing websites, it will bring up and create a map of who your web browsing is being reported to. And so it's hard to see here because of the scale, but the West Australian site's in the middle, and it shows that's where I got the here's the five that it is talking to. But then if you pop over to other sites like Facebook or Google, it can track you through. So there's this mesh of companies that your information is being collected by. And this is research that was published only the other day, 3rd of this month, so literally only the other day. F-Secure, which is a Finnish information security company, they've done some research on just how much tracking goes on. And if I find the exact quote, pretty much you will not know most of the URLs, that is the web addresses that are being informed of your stuff. Of the top URLs that are accessed by people in the world, only 15% of them are actually delivering the content that you asked for, like the West Australian site, the Sydney Morning Herald, Facebook, Twitter, Google, whatever. Of the remaining 85%, 10% come from ad-serving domains, the Google DoubleClick and et cetera, et cetera. 35% are ad-serving domains that also have this kind of tracking code in it that can keep track of exactly what pages you're looking at, when and for how long. And the one that I find interesting, 19% of them are domains that do nothing but tracking, not just the Nielsen net ratings, but there are others as well. And it's fair to say that most people never heard of these. Now, Mikko Hipponen, who's head of research at F-Secure, he said, we are more honest with search engines than we are with our families. Search engines know more about you than your family members do. And I think if you think about the kinds of things you may have searched for in the last 72 hours, that's possibly true. So what happens with all this data? Well, it's collected by the companies that I've named so far, the primary websites and then the advertising trackers. Then we have another layer of the food chain further up, the data brokers. Axiom, Equifax, Experian, Datalogix are some of the largest. They basically buy the data from everyone I've mentioned so far to create more sophisticated, more rich, more full, more complete dossiers. Now, they make no bones about collecting stuff that might have your name or email address or phone number attached, because in many cases, the data is coming from sources that have said, we value your privacy, but we will share this with our partners. And they never quite get around to saying who those partners are. These are the partners. Now, once you get that, these guys then sell that data out for commercial purposes, for political purposes. They also gather their own data. So we're talking about life triggers. I mean, when someone's born, when they died, when they get married, all of that's on public record. So is when they're charged with a crime or put in prison or released from prison, become bankrupt, released from bankrupt. All of that's on public record. Also flowing around that is financial information. Did you apply for a loan? Was the loan approved? Were you late paying that loan? Did you move house? Once you get up to having more of your life recorded in this way, you'll find that you'll move house, and then, or you start looking for a house, I should say, and suddenly you'll start getting emails from companies that offer removalist services and cardboard box hire. And then once you've booked with one of those, you'll start getting people saying, oh, would you like us to take care of moving your electricity bill? Have you got some furniture you want to get rid of? Would you like to buy some furniture? All of this becomes part of the commercial operation. We might decide, let's contact everyone who owns a BMW that's more than 5 years old, who earns more than $75,000 a year and has looked at a car website in the last 30 days. That is a thing you can buy. I should probably mention Facebook in this context, because Facebook has the like button, which they have on a bazillion other websites. So that means, again, you're hitting that website. Facebook knows that you've hit that website because they've got their like button embedded in the page. It doesn't matter whether you press the like button. It doesn't matter whether you're logged into Facebook at that moment or not, because they've already put a cookie on your computer and are tracking that through anyway. Facebook as well is gathering that. Facebook are really high up in the food chain at the moment. That's why they're worth, what, around $80 billion at the moment? Are they up to $100 billion yet? I haven't checked the share price just yet. But they're up not just in the scale of these guys, but beyond, because they're getting real-time information, I should say. And I'll come to location just in a minute, but I'll mention a thing I haven't got a slide for, but ProPublica, the US news website, everything we know about what data brokers know about you. I'll have it up on the website later, but that article basically does what it says on the tin. The US rules are a little more laissez-faire than Australia. We've got a new Privacy Act that came into force on the 14th of March, so that does tighten things up a bit. But it's still the case that if you just check the box that says, yeah, do what the hell you want with my data, then you press the button. Now, what can you find out from this? Do I have another slide for that? No, I don't. That goes on to the next thing. Target in the US, the shop chain, they're kind of some of the leaders in this. A few years ago, they discovered that they could tell with an 87% likelihood of being correct that a young woman had become pregnant because of the changes in her shopping list. We're talking things like body oil becomes non-scented rather than scented, certain vitamins will start appearing, certain other things might disappear from the diet, and so on. So what Target does is they will go, well, maybe we know that this woman responds to two-for-one offers, so we'll make sure when we do the next letterbox drop that she gets two-for-one on some product that's appropriate for the stage of pregnancy, and when we start getting to 8 and 9 months, we'll throw in diapers and blah, 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 and babysitting and stuff. There's a particular fun case to read where a father had this stuff turning up in his young daughter's mail, and he kicked off at Target big time. How dare you? My daughter is not pregnant. Blah, 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 blah. You know, what are you saying about my family? A couple of weeks later, he had to phone back to Target and apologise that he wasn't fully informed about what was happening in his household. So Target have get around that now. Because in the States, this hasn't kicked off in Australia yet, but in the States, you know, you will get a personalised version of the Target catalogue. So sure, all the pregnancy and baby stuff will be in there, but they'll just camouflage it by bumping up some car parts and some noodles and some power tools and, you know, stuff. So it's not immediately obvious that the person is being quite specifically targeted with advertising. Location data. Here's one of the big ones. You can uniquely identify an individual with fewer than 6 time-stamped locations. There are only so many people who are at Parramatta Railway Station at 6:24 a.m., at Central Station at 7:02 a.m., at UTS in this building at this time, and then lunch at another spot, and then at a gym in another spot in the course of the day. That is a unique individual path through time and space. That's all they need. It's one of the reasons why in the new Privacy Act, interestingly enough, that there was this old idea of personally identifiable information, and people thought that meant name, address, date of birth, email address, phone number. Now it means any collection of information from which you might reasonably infer the identity of the individual. And the example I throw into that, there are only so many 27-year-old female nurses in Stanmore with a 5-year-old child who work at the Royal North Shore Hospital. That is an individual. You don't need to know a name. You don't need to know anything else about her. You can then cross-match that with all the other data you have. And in fact, a friend of mine has the lovely job of re-identifying supposedly anonymous medical data. She's what we call a computational epidemiologist. She assembles data sets to track, oh, this person here who was born 34 years ago on this date in this hospital in this suburb, that's got to be the same person born on that date with this medical condition who showed up 20 years later, because both that person and that person, when they were 14 year old in March, broke their arm. And you can rest assured that these guys are doing plenty of that. So that brings us to the end of that. And I can give more scary examples later, but that's enough for the moment. Let's kick on to news. This news story, dated February last year, was written by a robot, not a human. Robots have been writing news for some years now. The LA Times obviously is interested in earthquakes. So basically, whenever the data feed from the US Geological Survey mentions that there has been an earthquake above a certain magnitude or within a certain distance of LA, the details are extracted from that data feed, plugged into a story template, a map is chosen, and blip, up that pops. There we go. There's the first news story about the earthquake. At that point, you can assign a human journalist to maybe go out and get some photos or talk to some people or see what happens. This is the blurb from a company called Narrative Science, which is one of the largest companies doing news. This is what people in the IT industry call marketecture. It looks like the architecture of an information system, but in fact doesn't explain anything. Receive data, create story, and deliver insight. Because I like that. That's just this magic thing that happens. But pretty much what Narrative Science do and have been doing for a number of years is junior grade and college level sport reportage throughout the United States. That's just look what time, which people scored how many points. There's only so many narrative templates a sporting match has after all. I hope none of you wanted to become sports journalists. Because basically it's hometown team does badly until the second half, until James Brown rallied with a 3-point throw, blah, 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 and brought it back, and they finished, you know, 38-27 for their highest scoring game this season. There's nothing in there that can't be automated. Apart from the occasional dreadful mistake these make, but they're getting better. Other stories, stock market stuff. A mining company suddenly has its share price go up one afternoon. Oh, is there any news previously in the week about this mining company? There is. Well, Bloggo Minerals has risen 37% this afternoon following news earlier this week that blah linked to headline. You know, other mining stocks rose only 4% today, putting them 3% ahead of the market average, etc. Again, you have a journalist who's employed once to write a whole lot of nifty templates, and then you hand it over to a programmer, and the journalist is, I don't know, taken out the back and shot, possibly, if it's Russia. Other things that are happening in the automotive... other examples of that, weekend real estate prices, same deal. There were X houses sold, median house value is whatever, up X percent from last year, higher selling suburbs, blah, blah, blah. So that's happening now. This is not a magic thing. LA Times has automated, as I say, earthquake stories for at least 18 months. Narrative Sciences has been going for a couple of years. We're going ahead of ourselves. Other people apart from narrative sciences that I should mention are Automated Insights. Yes, that's the other company, which I think is quite cute. I forgot to throw in one of my favourite little examples of what you can tell from tracking someone's online activity. It's a paper from 2009, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, links on my website later. By analysing the pattern of friend formation on Facebook, you can tell whether a young man is gay or not, often before he's figured it out himself. And on that note, a great blog that you should all be reading is called Monday Note. It's written by a couple of French guys, one who's Jean-Louis Gasset, who was chairman of Apple for some period, and Frédéric Filieu. Just look up Monday Note, you'll find their stuff. They essentially write about business models for the new media, and each one has an essay each Monday. It's simple as that. You've got two articles to read every Monday. They usually get them up Sunday night because they're old newspaper guys. Frédéric Filieu sketched out a scenario that's possibly not very far in the future at all. That someone applies for a job, and it's another female example, but why not? We have too many male examples in these sort of media things anyway. A recruiter is thinking of hiring her, but the research company that they hand over her name and email address to comes back and says, look, there's a pattern in the way she tweets, that some days she tweets with this kind of volume and intensity, and then it switches to this other pattern a couple of days. That's 94% associated with continual migraines. You know, that's indicative that she may have health problems. And we've also analysed her communications patterns on Facebook, and we think there's a 75% chance she'll become pregnant within the next 18 months. So you may want to factor that into your risk assessment. And I use the word risk assessment quite deliberately because that's how companies think about this. Now, I don't think there's anything in that scenario which is not already possible. In the United States, employers are already asking new employees to either hand over their Facebook passwords or to sit with them and log into Facebook so they can go through their social activities with them to make sure that they will not be a liability for the company in the future. I'm going to skip over a whole lot of stuff I had with more examples of how much stuff is buried in people's kind of click streams as they go through the internet, but I think you kind of get the idea. One thing I'll add to that is that once the data is out there in this ecosystem and once you've said it, I mean, you can't take the piss out of the pool, as the old saying goes. It's out there, and it can harm you in ways that we don't know about yet. What I've just described with that woman trying to get a job is, well, we don't know whether this will be possible or not already from what we've released online. There is already research which shows you can predict people's political voting patterns from the music playlists they posted as a teenager. It's already happening. And when you have social apps on your phone that say, oh, would you like to find your friends? Yeah, sure. And a copy of your address book is suddenly uploaded. And then another message goes out and says, oh, you may know this person. And that means one of your friends has just been sent the fact that you see Dr. Jones, the psychiatrist. Hang on, what? You both know Dr. Jones. Oh, really? Thanks for that. Now, the second part of this is the filter bubble. Oh, good. We've got plenty of time to plough through that. The filter bubble, if you've read the reading, you'll already know, is this idea that in the age of mass communication, we all saw more or less the same news. In the new age, we all see news tailored to our particular preferences, either because we chose them through something like Google News, where we said, yeah, lots of sport, no business news, whatever, or algorithms like those we've discussed are kind of looking at what we might be interested in and go, oh, you were browsing car sites, we'd better give you automotive news about the latest model. Not that, you know, that isn't news, of course, but there may be commercial advantage to our advertisers, perhaps. The idea that there is a filter bubble is real, and That's this next one. That is a map of the Twitter sphere in Australia. It's basically taking, I think it's about 11,000 odd people from Twitter, or it's in the tens of thousands perhaps, and joining them and putting them with a line for who they communicate with, and then drawing those groups together. The more that there are connections between a group of people, think of it as kind of rubber bands or something, pulling them down together to create these little clusters. And this is research done up in Queensland by Axel Bruns and Margaret Burgess? Margaret Burgess. Again, links in the thing. So people talk to each other with similar interests. There's no secret there. And at the core of this, what kind of everyone tends to talk about when they're on a service like Twitter, and don't think that this is purely about Twitter, I mean, it could be Facebook, it could be any social network, that conversations about the network itself, everyone is involved in them. Twitter's crashed, how do I upload a photo, whatever. As you move out, there's only some people are particularly interested in news, and we'll talk a bit more about this little subsection in a bit. People who read more opinion than news are a little bit closer to the centre of the universe, if you like. That people who only talk about hard news are a bit further out to the edge, as it were. They're certainly not everybody. The conservative journalists are even further out to the edge, interestingly enough. In this analysis, it's late 2012, this data is from. ALP progressives are over there, the Greens there, hardline conservatives there. This is back when Gillard and Rudd battles were very much in the news, so they personally are over there. Then you kind of get various people with various other interests scattered around. Perth has a fantastic communicates with itself marketing and PR community. The business and property people and real estate and jobs and HR are over there. There's a whole little island of parenting and mums and arts and crafts over there. Interesting that arts and crafts link. Oh, not really. You've got to keep kids amused, I suppose, don't you? But yeah, that becomes a cluster of interest over there. Food, wine, beer, and then Adelaide. I'm from Adelaide, so say what you like. I'll agree with you probably. Fashion and beauty, design, theatre, arts, film. Again, you can see these thematic clusters kind of make sense when you look at the interests people have in common. Music becomes more interesting because you find that these become little islands out by themselves, mostly because those people will not be communicating with other Australians. They'll be communicating mostly with other people around the world who share their interest and taste in music. And then we kind of have a commercial TV and sport kind of area down here, and a whole little cluster of teaching people, and the evangelical Christians off there who don't really talk to anyone but themselves. And oddly enough, the Hillsong evangelicals are a separate group again and don't talk to the rest of the evangelicals. So that's a bit odd. Now, mapped onto that, this is tracking the hashtag Queensland floods when they were a thing. And the density there is like everyone's talking about Queensland because it doesn't really matter what their interests are. If they're in Queensland, the floods are an issue, or if they have relatives there, that's an issue. It doesn't matter what music you're into, the Queensland floods will affect you. Aus votes, obviously more over to that kind of political edge of things. The Aus poll hashtag on Twitter is interesting because it's become more right-wing and more polarised. So, in fact, since this was written, Axel Bruns told me that Auspol really has turned into hard left and hard right people shouting at each other and not much else. I didn't have time to get his latest chart. He was still working at it over the weekend. WikiLeaks, tends to, for example, be a topic both within the kind of left-wing politosphere and in the right-wing side, because they think WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, is the devil incarnate. So that happens. Now, there's some newer research now from the Pew Center, the Pew Research Center in the US. Pew Internet, pewinternet.org, is a place you should spend a lot of time as well. They are a non-profit that is studying the way the internet is changing the American people, and they do fantastic social research. That's proper stuff. And this is from one they did earlier this year, Mapping Twitter Topic Networks. Whereas the charts we've just seen is the overall connections, this is now specific conversations. They said, what if we look at that, just what happens over a two-day period? And this is an example of haven't got the date in front of me. The research came out a few weeks ago, but I'm not sure when they did this, but it was some point last year, where they said, okay, just for 2 days, we will track all of the conversations around a particular hashtag, #MY2K, which is related to a political event in the United States. What that is not important. What is important is this is one picture. This is the fact that you've got the Democrats on one side and the Republicans on the other, the Democrats listening to left-wing news sources and talking amongst themselves and reading left-wing commentators and so on, and the other side, the Republicans are doing the same, and there's very little cross-conversation between the two groups. That is the filter bubble, right there. And that has implications for how news is delivered. And for political parties, how you change people's views if all they're listening to and talking about and talking with are people they already agree with. That's a real example over 2 days. Great research to look up. They identified essentially these six kinds of conversations, and this is just the polarised crowd, they called it, which happens when you get controversial political events. The other five kinds show different kinds of conversations around different kinds of communities. So it's well worth spending your time playing with that. It's eminently readable. Now, this came up at the last election. Whole series of tweets, all saying exactly the same thing. Saw one again the other day. That's because a significant proportion, maybe 10 or 15% of all of the accounts active on Twitter are in fact robots. And some of them are there to just spray advertising. Some of them are organised criminals hoping you'll click on a link and go through. This happened where everyone in this random group kicked off complaining about a Greens ad. Now, this was not actually intended to be a political attack. This was a group of robots deciding to retweet random things so they looked more human, and whatever their real mission was buried in amongst that. We just happened to see that because we were looking for political tweets in Australia. Here's one of those people, Benjamin Erb, and these are all created completely automatically. His profile, registered patent attorney and representing clients ranging from startup ventures to Fortune 500. Yeah. And it says he's in Kenechi, Hawaii. So why is Johnny P. DC? That means he'd be in Washington, surely. And then when you look at what he's tweeting about, it makes no sense. It's random tweets stolen from other people, just in among things. You know, like the third one, work Dead Sea Jordan Amman. I mean, what is he on about? But basketball is always going to be my favourite sport. You know, I've been tempted to turn these into a script for, you know, actually do them. Yes, sir?
Don't we have a right to know who's a robot and who's not? How did you figure that out?
That's a fantastic question. Robot rights versus human rights is actually a thing. There are leading-edge lawyers explaining once, for example, robots reach a certain sentience, should they have rights? Which I think is kind of a bit crazy now. Right, do we have a right to know who's a robot or not? No. We don't. Well, we talk to robots all the time. Every time you phone Telstra, you start off talking to a robot. But that's really obvious, because, hi, in just a few words, please say what you're interested in. That's a really obvious robot. There are other more subtle robots. There are actually robots now doing outbound call centre work. And people have only realised that when they've got the robot off the script. And they say, sorry, I understand. Sorry, I didn't quite. Yeah, it's really natural. I get actors in to do it, not voiceover artists. And hang on, sorry, I'm not sure what you mean. And then a few minutes later, I'm sorry, I'm not sure what you mean. What? Hang on, what? That was triggered again, and that's the same thing. No, we currently do not have any right to know whether we're talking to a human or a robot.
What about the picture? Who is that?
That will be stolen, just a picture pinched off the internet. Could be anyone. I have known of an individual whose face has turned up as a robot.
But isn't that like some sort of identity theft?
Well, it's nicking the photos. Copyright theft, certainly. But then, yeah, identity theft is, again, a fuzzy area of law. And impersonation, yeah, but intent to what? So creating false impressions can be a civil offence if you've caused hurt or damage. Going on to that to commit financial fraud is therefore a crime, and that's that's, you know, I steal your credit cards and your driver's license and open another credit card in your name. That's it. That's credit card fraud. But beyond that, no, it's a really fuzzy area. Particularly as there is also, in some jurisdictions, a right to parody. I mean, otherwise you can't have actors. I mean, or satire. It's a very fuzzy area. It comes down to it. These guys are pushing the edge. There's a question up the back. Correct. They're automated. And what they're hoping, they're particularly hitting accounts that might be private, so that if you follow them, they're hoping you might open up, or that you'll message them, or they'll send you a link to a website that then will infect your phone with malware and take over. The Instagram ones, though, are more about advertising at the moment. There kind of tends to be a scale of when the attacks happen against you. It starts off with advertising, and then it's low-grade fraud to say, hi, your phone has 2 viruses on it. Click here. Oh, yes, definitely 2 viruses. Can we have your credit card number? And more sophisticated fraud happens when there's enough of a customer base to make it worthwhile for the criminals. One minute left. Then all I will say is that I'll throw you my one little example. So imagine combining all of that. You are in the bus, travelling through the western suburbs. It's during an election campaign. You pass a certain football stadium, and suddenly you get a message via SMS which says, Labor refused to pay for the $500,000 upgrade for that stadium, and we know you're interested in rugby. Click here for further information. I called it the attack of the politiclones, but that I suppose is the very beginning. I better cut it there or Belinda will kill me. Thank you very much. I'll be around for a bit if you need to follow anything up.